Les colloques du Collège de France.
Merci d'avoir respecté la consigne d'être ponctuel pour le début de la deuxième partie de cette session de la matinée. Deuxième partie intitulée « Auteur du génocide, individuel, collectif et ou institutionnel ». Donc, premier orateur, le professeur Mark Levin, qui va nous parler en anglais de « The Elephant in the Room, Genocides, Past, Present and Future in an Era of Anthropogenic Omnicide ». Donc, le professeur Levin est membre émérite en histoire du Parks Center for Jewish and Non-Jewish Relations de l'Université de Southampton. Il a étudié et enseigné l'histoire juive moderne, mais au cours de la dernière décennie, il a tracé et tenté d'interpréter le schéma des génocides dans l'histoire récente. Il s'intéresse également, entre autres, aux questions relatives aux droits des minorités, qu'elles soient juives ou non, plus particulièrement en ce qui concerne le stress lié à la guerre et au service militaire, aux relations entre l'État et les communautés ethniques sous le mandat britannique en Palestine, et la transition entre Empire ottoman et les États successeurs du Moyen-Orient. Il a également travaillé dans des organisations de lutte pour la paix et a été militant pour l'environnement. Il a cofondé le Crisis Forum et fondé Rescue History. Toutes ces préoccupations se retrouvent dans le titre de ces nombreuses publications, dont je ne cite que quelques-unes. Par exemple, Genocide in the Age of the Nation State, Harbingers of Jewish and Palestinian Disasters, European Nation State Building and Its Toxic Legacies from 1912 to 1948, et History at the End of the World, History, Climate Change and the Possibility of Closure, et Surviving Climate Change, c'est ce qu'on essaie de faire maintenant, The Struggle to Avert Global Catastrophe.
Nice.
Yeah, the elephant in the room.
Merci, Madame la Présidente.
Pour commencer, je voudrais remercier chaleureusement les professeurs Besson et Laurent pour l'opportunité de participer à cette colloque. Dommage que mon français ne soit pas très bon, et je suis sincèrement désolé, surtout pour le public, que cette présentation soit en anglais. Donc, the term remigration, largely as a consequence of the rise of the German Alternative for Deutschland Party, has recently entered a wider popular lexicon. Viewed through a more critical lens, Zygmunt Bauman's borrowing from Claude Lévi-Strauss of the term anthropemia, conjuring up notions of a vomiting out from the body politic of those elements considered to be non-digestible, might be more pungently apt. The last time Germany, as a matter of state policy, began its descent into wholesale anthropemia was in October 1938, when thousands of otherwise German-domiciled Jews with Polish citizenry were deported to the Polish border, where, given that Warsaw refused to let them in, languished for months in conditions of increasing degradation, largely in a no-man's land at the Zaboshin border crossing. Today, we tend to remember Zaboshin where we remember it at all, primarily as a prelude to Kristallnacht, the great night of Nazi nationwide anti-Jewish terror and pyromania. Some historians consider this event as the antechamber to the Holocaust. Usually left out of this equation is the manner in which the example of Zaboshin sparked off an anthropemic chain reaction elsewhere in Europe. Poland followed suit. It already had plans to remove as many as possible of its 3 million Jews. Slovakia, newly created state, also followed suit. A Jewish refugee crisis was in train, for which there was a conference at Evian. But even so, countries in Western Europe, like Britain and France, simply drew up the drawbridge and said, this is nothing to do with us. The Evian delegate from France, Henri Boulanger, famously said, La France, c'est un passage, pas un garage. As things moved towards war, other countries took on a much more unilateral position on what they were going to do. But one should also be reminded, in countries like France and elsewhere in Western Europe, so-called clandestine, otherwise Jews without a place to call home, found themselves most usually incarcerated in camps, this is before the Second World War, pending anticipated deportation to somewhere else. For more radically orientated countries like Hungary and Romania, they went a step further as war came closer. Unilaterally deporting either foreign Jews who had sought refuge on their territory or whole chunks of frontier residing ones, now cast into this same stateless category across international borders beyond their responsibility. The fact that they did this in the summer of 1941 into the war zone created by the Nazi invasion of the Soviet Union, of itself would not constitute genocide under the terms of the 1948 Convention. Instead, it was left to the Nazis to spectacularly demonstrate how a human-created refugee crisis could be resolved through mass murder. They did so at a place called Kamenets-Podolsk in the Soviet Ukraine, but actually at a near intersection with the Polish, Hungarian, formerly Czech, and Romanian borders. In the annals of the Holocaust, this late August 1941 three-day massacre is significant not just because it involved the first five-figure Nazi killing of 23,600 Jews, but 23,600 men, women, and children. Paradoxically, if we were looking at this event through a convention lens, we discern aspects which in a courtroom might be considered problematic. For one thing, the massacre was clearly not pre-planned or part of some grand final solution design. On the contrary, the whole exercise seems to have been hastily improvised, involving a largely scratch force of order policemen and Ukrainian auxiliaries, albeit under the supervision of Frederick Jeckeln, the outstanding SS organizer of open-air mass killing. For another, one can almost imagine a Nazi mitigating plea of necessary contingency on grounds that the mostly refugees murdered here represented an unanticipated security threat in the Wehrmacht's rear, demanding urgent resolution. getting into the mindset, which I'm sure Professors Bartov and Angrea will tell us more about later, is not my purpose here. What is a case of acknowledging that what happened at Kamenets-Podolsk was the culmination of a series of political choices by different states to turn masses of their citizens into refugees, or alternatively deny others their right of asylum. The resulting tipping point, to use more Anthropocene speak, coming when this aggregate of Jewish diversity, otherwise an irresolvable refugee logjam, was liquidated Nazi style. Let's fast forward 84 years. European state energies would seem to be less fixated today, at least in immediate terms, on vomiting out masses of unwelcome, indigestible people. If we were to move right now to what is happening in Los Angeles, in the US, we would see that the American view on anthropemia, the American state, Trumpist view, is a little bit more acute and transparent. The European view, by contrast, is more on denying ingress in the first place. One firm indication of this is the increasing centrality of Frontex, whose funding has been astronomically, exponentially rising since 2005 to by a degree of a mere 13,200% increase. What is the money going on? Much of the answer lies in militarized, fortified front borders. Even then, some EU members are responding to increasing numbers of asylum seekers, more or less outside of Frontex's umbrella. A case in point is Poland, a key section of whose 186-kilometer razor wire bristling 5.5 meter high Belarus frontier fence passes close to the village of Czernica. The border crossing here has been turned into an exclusion zone, supported by state-of-the-art surveillance and patrolled by heavily armed guards. It also happens to cut through Podlasie, a historically polyglot region, itself part of a much broader, multi-ethnic Eastern European rimlands, including 641 kilometers to the south, Kamenets-Podolsk. Podlasie, hardly coincidentally, also happens to be the birthplace of one Raphael Lemkin. However, today, rather than displaying welcome signs to the tens of thousands of diverse people seeking European safe haven and hailing at the last NGO count from some 51 countries, the Czernica crossing would seem to be more akin to a Roman barbarians at the gate reenactment. Speaking in February 2024, trailing a law suspending the country's right of asylum, Polish Prime Minister Donald Tusk pronounced that the survival of Western civilization depends upon preventing uncontrolled migration. We must wake up, he said, and understand that we have to protect our territory, our borders, and that if we open up to all forms of migration without any control, our world will collapse. Tusk added, we will do what we have to do in order not to violate legal standards and to prevent situations that violate the core of humanitarianism. In quotes, it cannot be that people are dying on the Polish side of the border. Indeed, according to the NGO we are monitoring, the primary method of preventing migrant border crossing is push back the use of extreme force, short of lethality, as buttressed by recently extended powers permitting guards to use their weapons, even if in contravention of both European and international law. The result, hundreds, if not thousands, of migrants today languish in misery in a no man's land on the Belarus side of the border. To be sure, in this particular story, there is the backdrop of Putin's proxy, Belarus President Lukashenko's efforts to weaponize the migrant crisis against the EU. By contrast, too, not only is Tusk a good European in the democratic centrist tradition, but with the further alibi that one could point to state-condoned violence along other European borders and beyond, where the evidence is much worse. If we were, for instance, to look for mass migrant crises entangled with the reality or at least plausibility of genocide, we would need to jump continents to Gaza, where the Israeli state goal of ethnic cleansing is patent, to Sudan, currently the world's largest war zone involving mass people displacement, or to the Bangladesh-Myanmar border, where failed Bangladeshi efforts to repatriate the over 1 million Rohingyas, mostly languishing in one single camp, Kutupalong, the world's largest single refugee camp, one should add, would amount to a case of returning them to a region from which Myanmar's military regime had genocidally vomited them out in the first place. Even so, the situation on the Polish border and what is happening in the rest of the world cannot be so easily dismissed. For one thing, while the NGOs identified migrants all come from an impoverished global south, the vast majority are either Syrian nationals or from countries in the Greater Horn of Africa where climate-related ecosystem breakdown and consequent starvation is at its most acute. For another, the Tusk imaginary speaks not only to an emotional geography of national territories and borders, but in quotes, the fear of being overwhelmed by the other. And with it, suggests Dominic Moisi, the fear of an uncertain and menacing future over which there is little, if any, possible human control. Could it be this same fear which led, for instance, in January 2008, to five of the most senior retired NATO military thinkers, four of them European, from issuing a manifesto urging the alliance to maintain its nuclear first strike option by citing, amongst other things, the critical threat from potential environmental migration on a mass scale? It's time to introduce the elephant in the room, the biospheric crisis, anthropogenic climate change for short. It's not our concern here to reprise the science behind the shock of the Anthropocene, except in terms of its intra-human consequences. Mass migration, to be sure, is only one of these. But the rapid acceleration and the sheer numbers of displaced people either within countries or crossing international borders is now acknowledged as having a deepening climate pulse. The most recent UNHCR figures state that 1 in 69 of the world's population, over 117 million people, have now been forcibly displaced in the present. That compares with a figure of 41 million in 2010. But if these numbers are essentially conflict-driven, the cross-relationship with countries in the global south suffering acute climate breakdown cannot be overstated. Academic eyebrows were certainly raised when, in 2005, the Oxford academic Norman Myers estimated that failing a radical reduction in greenhouse gas emissions, there could be 200 million climate migrants by 2050. So what are we to make of a more recent NGO forecast? That over half of the world's population, by that same centennial midway point, are likely to be suffering high or extreme water stress, and of these, over 1 billion people are likely to be displaced due to a combination of environmental breakdown, conflict, and civil unrest. It hardly requires rocket science to understand why. Sustained extreme weather events, as outside, a minor episode. Maybe the headline news. But the pulse of underlying factors, sea level rise, deltaic and coastal inundation, acute soil depletion, glacial melt, sustained drought, above all, with year-on-year global temperatures now heading towards a potential of 3 to 4 degree rise by the end of the century. The collapse of parametric conditions within which staple cereal crops can grow anywhere except the most northern climes all speak to human populations, as with ecosystems, having no choice but to move. To be sure, the speed of climate change will outpace either's ability to do so. Earth scientists are not being facetious when they speak of a sixth extinction. The 2024 breach in the 1.5 degree temperature threshold agreed in the Paris Climate Treaty is no more than a harbinger of the multiple Earth system tipping points and the collapse of so-called planetary boundaries, which scientists have been warning could cascade into an irreversible new climate system. Back in 2004, a highly controversial Pentagon report considered such an abrupt climate scenario, which included the disruption of the thermohaline circulation we associate with the winter temperature moderating Gulf Stream. In the scenario, the effects on millions of Northwest Europeans was death by starvation in Siberian-like conditions, or an attempt to flee elsewhere. One criticism at the time of the report was that its focus on abrupt rather than gradual climate change. Yet a recent scientific assessment about a potential tipping point collapse or one or more components of this ocean circulation has raised the spectre of an effective wipeout of UK food production. What matters for us here is not the predictive accuracy of the scientific modelling, but the very fact that security agencies, not only in the US, but throughout the global north, have been at the forefront of state responses to the climate emergency. Their interest, however, is rarely focused on the first cause of the crisis, namely the planetary unsustainability of the present global fossil fuel-dependent economic system. Instead, it is primarily centered on crisis symptoms, especially mass migrant flows, not so much from within the global north, but is generally assumed from the global south, and hence with ploughing further resource into frontier securitization. This state of siege mentality is further illustrated in a 2008 war game organized by the US think tank, the Center for New American Security, which imagined a future climate-related breakdown, including a mass environmental exodus from poor countries. Its gamers were a panel of distinguished military, state, and corporate policymakers and strategists, representing leading industrial nations. No one from the poor global south was invited to participate. The concluding framework agreement involved a preferred repatriation of climate refugees or migrants by non-coercive means where possible. No further assessment was proffered on how all these refugee millions, including from inundated delta regions or submerged islands, might be repatriated, let alone non-violently. At this point, your patients may be wearing thin, while at the same time you might be asking, what has any of this got to do with the Genocide Convention? The convention which deals with refugees is another piece of post-war international legislation, the 1951 UN Refugee Convention. Despite many efforts to update its rule book, not least by Professor Chimilia Gendro, it, however, continues to lack any reference to environmental, let alone climate refugees. As for our 1948 convention, the notion of climate crisis was clearly a world away from its drafters' cognizance. But they, more precisely the convention's dominant UN, British, French, and Soviet makers, could hardly have been unaware of an immediate post-war world which was awash with the violent vomiting out or terror-driven flight of peoples, not least because they had been or continued to be carried out on territories for which they either had colonial responsibility, as in the case of British Palestine and India, or involved wholesale deportation, often of entire national groups, or yet again by Potsdam imprimatur, as in the case of by Potsdam imprimatur led to the mass ethnic cleansing of Eastern Central European peoples, mostly but far from exclusively ethnic German. These late war and post-war man-made refugee crises, an anthropemia unbound, with overall death tolls running into millions, also, however, represented a direct challenge to the still embryonic Genocide Convention. Lemkin's own most basic and succinct articulation of what that should have been about: genocide is the denial of the right of existence of entire human groups. The lead wording of the resolution on the crime of genocide passed in a UN plenary in December 1946. However, if we read William Shabas, was not included in the subsequent committee debates on the convention, with Lemkin, of course, by that time absent, and was quite deliberately resisted. So Professor Shabas tells us, the drafters quite deliberately resisted attempts to encompass phenomena of ethnic cleansing within the punishable acts. We should neither be surprised nor shocked. The convention's final 1948 text was quite intentionally set on a narrow plinth, first and foremost, in order to protect its powerful state creators from potential comeback. Potential victim groups, by contrast, no longer even had the scant League of Nations protection previously bestowed in the interwar minorities treaties, part of whose great power purpose had been to deny Eastern European nation states the impunity with which to vomit them out into their own domestic spheres. How long have I got?
2 minutes.
Oh, my Lord. Can I have a bit longer? Four? Yeah.
Look at this.
But these treaties have been duly dumped by the Allied founders of the nascent UN, the UN Convention offering no rights for distinctive groups, cultural groups, only the possibility that if special intent of a project of their destruction could be proven in a court of law, that is, after all of them or some of them had been physically annihilated, perpetrators could be found guilty of the act. I'm trying to think what to do here, actually, Professor Sheng. Let me just jump a little bit to my last two pages. Paradoxically, the convention itself, what the convention really is, the reality of the convention may be hiding in plain sight and may tell us about aspects of its inherent dysfunction. Who, after all, are the national, ethnical, religious, and racial groups which it enumerates? But people who do not meet the prescript of coherent, culturally homogenized, territorially fixed, internationally border demarcated societies, which an emergent European Westphalianism bequeathed as its template for nation state building worldwide. The obverse side, speaking in Balmanesque terms, of each modern nation state's anthropophagic embrace of diverse family, cult, kinship, and cultural communities within its universe of obligation, in order for these communities to merge and function with its own developmental striving within the international system, is the opposite to that, is its anxiety, its psychopathology about those other people who it perceives to be destabilizing, undermining, or contaminating this raison d'etre. In the next section, I talk about Romani people as an example of that, people who cross frontiers, and what happens to Romani historically who cross frontiers. The men were killed en masse, by a Holy Roman Emperor decree. The women and children had their ears cut off before they were thrown back over the border. Gypsies, the term gypsies, clandestine, illegals. In place of gypsies and Jews, how will the fortress world of rich protected enclaves, the Schengen area included, aggregate all the other peoples from today's global south? Muslim is already one obvious marker for dissolving all manner of communities into a single blanket, one-dimensional conglomerate to be denied hospitality under any circumstances. But then in a world awash with displaced human beings, perhaps the very terminology of refugee, or perhaps simply alien, will render redundant the specificity of the convention's currently named victim groups, or then demand of its legal experts a recognition of what we think of as genocide today. I think what I'm trying to say in essence, let me try and cut to the chase, is we think of genocide and upholding genocide as the importance of the genocide as a convention, but we have to see it in a bigger context. It is important what Lemkin was trying to do, and it will be increasingly important in a world which will have the greatest stress test put upon humans in the entirety of our existence. We are now in a species emergency. Will the genocide convention's upholders ignore that? And the question then becomes, if they focus too much on just genocide, will it end up being a case of fiddling with the specificity of that while Rome burns?
Thank you.
Thank you.
Collège de France, le savoir en illimité. Retrouvez tous nos contenus audio et vidéo sur notre site collège-de-france.fr, les plateformes de podcast et nos chaînes YouTube.